listening to North Carolina Reading Service. Hello again, and welcome back to Time Magazine. I'm Randall Rickman, your reader for Time, and the content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This edition of Time Magazine is a double issue, so it's dated twice, December 2nd, 2019, and December 9th, 2019. We go right to the back of the book to make sure we have time to include the interview feature for this edition. This time it's called Eight Questions. Interview is conducted by Eben Shapiro. Subject of the interview is Stephen A. Schwartzman. Time says the Blackstone CEO on his new book, Income Inequality, President Trump, and the Benefits of Therapy. First question. Your book, What It Takes, Lessons in the Pursuit of Excellence, has 13 pages of acknowledgments. But I was most struck that you included your therapist. How long have you been in therapy, and how has that helped you? Answer. My internist referred me to a therapist in 1990, when I was considering getting divorced, but I didn't know anything about how you got divorced. I'm still seeing that individual. He is a terrific coach and observer of the scene and a brilliant tactician in terms of understanding small group interactions. Question. Income inequality is one of the defining issues of the upcoming election. You're the CEO of Blackstone, with an estimated net worth of more than $18 billion. Are you worried about a revolution or at least a wealth tax? Answer. There are a lot of people now who are starting to, with a very developed knowledge basis, respond to a lot of these issues. Steve Ratner wrote a very perceptive op-ed about why these proposals don't work. Or worse, they can destroy, potentially, some major aspects of the American economic system. On the other hand, the reason that you have populism increasing is because at least 25% of Americans are in a disadvantageous position economically. And I don't refer to it as income inequality. I refer to it as, because there's always been wealthy people in America, income insufficiencies. Question. How did we get here? Answer. It doesn't have anything to do with capitalism, per se. It has to do with the fact that the world changed. What's happened is that we've stopped adequately preparing our population for the world that we're living in, let alone the world of the future in the information age. This is a political problem. This is not a capitalism problem. Question. Given the record heights of the market, what do you worry about now? Answer. I think the biggest risks are political and geopolitical. They're not economic. Those are the things I worry about. Question. Alan Greenspan famously tracked cardboard boxes as economic indicators. What do you monitor? Answer. We each have our own favorite things. In the non-statistical variety, I have a few signs of when you are at a top. One of them is when your not-so-gifted friends start getting very rich. Question. You've known the president for 30 years, and he selected you to head the now disbanded Strategic and Policy Forum. Do you think he's doing a good job of leading the country? Answer. Everybody's got their own view. Mine is not going to help the sum total of knowledge. I think that in the areas where I've been more active, which are economic, that I think we're making actually good progress in the trade area with China. Question. You've recently been given a high honor by the President of Mexico for your work on the trade deal. Do you worry about walls and a less hospitable environment to global trade? Answer. The world generally is moving to more populism, more nationalism. Part of this has to do with the internet and social media. If you talk to the people running governments around the world, they'll tell you it's increasingly hard to run a liberal democracy. There's almost no issue today where very small groups of people aren't basically attacking the majority and defeating what a majority wants to get their own way. Final question. Do you think that's happening in this country now? Answer. Of course it is. Interview by Eben Shapiro with Stephen A. Schwartzman, Blackstone CEO, on his new book. The title of the book is What It Takes, Lessons in the Pursuit of Excellence. Schwartzman is spelled S-C-H-W-A-R-Z-M-A-N. Now we go to the front of the book, and we are starting with the major section that opens a magazine called The Brief. The section that opens The Brief is Opener, and here the subsection is World, where the headline is A Siege in Hong Kong Heralds a New Phase, by Lainey Barron, Dateline, Hong Kong. For almost 6 months, the unrest in Hong Kong has followed a rhythm. On weekends, the Chinese-ruled enclave would convulse with pro-democracy protests. During the work week, the acid haze of tear gas would clear and life moved on, though the revolutionary graffiti haranguing the Communist Party of China lingered. But in November, the struggle took a sudden and dangerous new turn. After a student demonstrator died on November 8th of complications from a fall during a protest, the weekly schedule surrendered to daily urban warfare. The demonstrators say normality cannot be restored. Quote, we can't just protest on the weekends anymore, unquote, says Izo, a 20-year-old medical student. Quote, if we are going to win this fight, people need to stop their jobs. The government needs to see the economy will hurt. Unquote. The latest escalation eventually centered on the city's universities, where students like Izo hold up to resist arrest. That places of learning have become battlegrounds strikes at the symbolic heart of the freedoms and values that Hong Kongers believe distinguish their semi-autonomous city from the rest of China. While Beijing has tried for years to push patriotic education here, and state media have suggested that changes to the curriculum might solve the crisis, faculty, students, and staff have resisted attempts to infringe on their academic independence. With on-campus lectures canceled, students' energies went into stockpiling medieval-style weaponry like fencing blades, slingshots, and bows and arrows, and fortifying blockades in preparation for showdowns with police. After some of the bloodiest confrontations since the unrest began, demonstrators filtered into one last holdout, Polytechnic University. Protesters hunkered down inside the campus for a week, using it as a base to disrupt traffic and block the adjoining Cross Harbor Tunnel, a vital artery linking the city's most populous region to the commercial and financial districts on Hong Kong Island. Police encircled the area, and a days-long siege began in earnest on November 17th. Students returned a hailstorm of rubber bullets and tear gas volleys with gasoline bombs, fiery arrows, and barricades set ablaze. Some managed to evade the police in daring escapes, including rappelling down makeshift ropes to waiting motorcycles. But many more were detained. By November 19th, police said they had arrested or taken down the details of 1,100 people in and around Pauley U. As time went to press, dozens remained inside, refusing to surrender. Although the size of the demonstrations has dwindled in recent weeks, it is no longer only student provocateurs squaring off with police. Amid a growing sense that peaceful protest is futile, the city's financial district is now regularly shrouded with tear gas in the middle of the workday. At lunchtime, bankers have joined street brawls, facing off with police against the backdrop of Chanel and Louis Vuitton stores. Amid a general strike, transportation has snarled, and public schools were forced into a six-day shutdown. Quote, "This is no longer just a protest movement," unquote, says Yu, a 21-year-old student. Quote, "We are at war for Hong Kong's future," unquote. Yet, as the frontline protesters have grown more radical, committing arson, vandalizing subway stations, and even dousing one detractor in flammable liquid and setting him on fire, they continue to retain public support. A survey by the Hong Kong Public Opinion Research Institute, published on November 15th, found 83% of people faulted the government for the spiraling violence, while fewer than half blamed the demonstrators. Quote, "Whatever they do, I will support the protesters," unquote, says Tim 30, a hotel worker who says he stopped joining the protests after they became more violent. Quote, "If we don't support them, we will have a worse future with no more rights," unquote. While the students at Pauley U camped out, ordinary Hong Kongers came to their aid. Some traveled hours to bring supplies, while a group of cheery-eyed relatives and friends staged a sit-in in front of police, who refused them access to the university. Other demonstrators staged a Blossom Everywhere campaign to draw police away from the institution. This protracted unrest has taken a toll on workers like Tim. As tourists stay away, almost 8 in 10 hotel staffers have been asked to take a few days unpaid leave, according to a union poll. Hong Kong has fallen into recession as its upscale hotels and glitzy shopping malls become backdrops to bloody duels. Many outside Hong Kong now fear what will befall Asia's world city. On November 19th, the U.S. Senate unanimously passed the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act, which aims to safeguard the territory's autonomy from any incursions by Beijing. But China sees the bill as an infringement on its sovereignty and already blames the current crisis on meddling foreign forces. For all the protections and declarations of support the world may try to offer, many Hong Kongers say they cannot afford to lose this fight because the alternative would mean an end to the city's unique set of freedoms. And so for all the disruptions, chaos, and danger, they would still rather live by the fits and starts of the protests than the dictates of Beijing. Quote, "I am much more afraid," unquote, says Brian, a 30-year-old protester, quote, "of what will happen if we don't stand up," unquote. Entire article from Hong Kong by Lainey Barron. In the middle of this article is an inserted full-feature, full-length photograph. Caption says, Carrie Lam, Hong Kong's chief executive. And it has a quote from her. Time says, to reporters on November 19th. The quotation above her picture in red is, quote, They have to stop violence, give up their weapons, and come out peacefully. Unquote. On the opposite page, still in the brief, this subsection is called The Bulletin, where the headline is, Iran goes dark as riots surge over a gas price hike. Article by Joseph Hinks. On November 16th, in a bid to quell rioting that broke out after Iran's state oil company announced fuel price hikes, Iranian authorities implemented a near total internet blackout. The shutdown makes it difficult to gauge the scale of unrest, but Amnesty International says at least 106 protesters have been killed. And Iran's semi-official Farsi news agency has reported that more than 1,000 people have been arrested. Videos smuggled out of the country show torched municipal buildings and abandoned cars blocking highways as Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei blames the riots on external forces trying to, quote, sabotage, unquote, Iran. And here Joseph Hinks lists three items. First item, domestic discontent. U.S. sanctions imposed since May 2017 have crippled Iran's economy, led to food shortages, and fueled anger at the country's leadership. On November 15th, the National Iranian Oil Company raised gas prices by 50% to 300%, an increase the authorities say will raise $2.55 billion a year for direct payments to citizens. Iran began rushing out those payments on November 18th, the same day the New York Times and The Intercept published some 700 pages of leaked Iranian intelligence agency cables. Second item, Iran's playbook. Blocking the internet nationwide may signal even greater fear about the gas price protests. During street protests against economic hardship and corruption in 2017-2018, Tehran disabled internet access from cell phones and blocked messaging services to prevent protesters organizing. Speaking after protests erupted elsewhere in the region in October, Khamenei blamed U.S. interference and praised the 2018 crackdown in Iran, saying, quote, the armed forces were ready and that plot was neutralized, unquote. Final item. Axis of resistance. The domestic turbulence comes at a troubling time for Tehran. Economic worries have prompted protests in Lebanon and Iraq, both in Iran's sphere of influence, and forced Lebanon's prime minister to resign. Iran-linked militias have also been involved in direct violence in Iraq. And the leaked cables detail years of Iranian interventions there, bolstering protesters in Iran who say their leaders have spent billions on overseas proxies while neglecting unemployment and corruption at home. Cutting off the internet will make it harder for protesters to organize, but it won't solve those problems. Entire article by Joseph Hinks. Sharing this page is the sidebar feature, News Ticker. It's in the right margin, and as usual, it is three news items stacked one on top of the other. Top item, Prince retreats over Epstein friendship. Britain's Prince Andrew announced on November 20th that he was stepping back from royal duties, quote, for the foreseeable future, unquote, 4 days after a BBC interview in which he defended his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. He said his links to Epstein had become, quote, a major disruption, unquote, to the royals. Central item. Syracuse reels after racist incidents. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo said November 19th that Syracuse University needs to do more to address a string of racist incidents on campus, including graffiti as well as slurs yelled at students. 2 days earlier, the school announced that a donor had provided $50,000 in reward money for information on who is responsible. Bottom item, Sweden drops Assange rape investigation. On November 19th, Swedish prosecutors dropped an investigation into a rape allegation from 2010 against WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, citing weakened evidence over time. Assange, imprisoned in London after spending 7 years in the UK's Ecuadorian embassy until he was evicted in April, denies the charge. That was a news ticker. Turning the page, that brings us to the milestones page. Lead item under died. Terry O'Neill, Lens on the Stars. Observance by Harry Benson. Time says Benson, CBE, commander of the British Empire, is a photographer. Benson writes, I remember Terry O'Neill as a Nazi dresser with a Cockney accent, which was all the rage in the late 1950s. When Terry replaced me as a photographer at the Daily Sketch of London, and I moved to the London Daily Express. That was one of his first jobs, and Terry, who died at 81 on November 16th, went on to create enduring images of icons from Frank Sinatra to Brigitte Bardot. His own life was glamorous, too. Once Terry and his then-wife, Faye Dunaway, brought their new baby, Liam, over to our apartment in a wicker basket to meet my wife, Gigi, and me, and our doorman was delighted to see a movie star. I never saw Terry on a news story, but I would always see him at the opening of a new film or at a press call with an upcoming new actress. The actor Michael Caine once said to me, quote, Terry really loves show business, unquote. To me, Terry was show business, and he has some great photographs to prove it. This item is accompanied by a candid photograph. Caption says, O'Neill, who was awarded a Commander of the British Empire, parenthetically CBE, just months before his death, O'Neill with actor Charlotte Rampling in 1988. The photograph is black and white, and it shows Terry O'Neill making adjustments to the setting, and an assistant is working on the appearance of actor Charlotte Rampling, and the subject, Charlotte Rampling, is actually looking through the lens of another camera, checking out what the view will look like. Terry O'Neill. Under apologized, Michael Bloomberg for stop and frisk. Observance by Tara Law. As New York City Mayor, Michael Bloomberg defended stop and frisk to the end. When a judge ruled in 2013 that the NYPD's practice of patting down anyone deemed suspicious was, quote, indirect racial profiling, unquote, Bloomberg responded, quote, we go to where the reports of crime are. Those, unfortunately, happen to be poor neighborhoods and minority neighborhoods, unquote. Police made almost 5 million such stops, 82% of which involved Black or Latinx people, from 2003 to 2013, per the New York Civil Liberties Union. 6 years later, as he mulls a presidential bid as a Democrat, Bloomberg has apologized. At a Black church in Brooklyn on November 17th, he acknowledged, quote, far too many innocent people were being stopped, unquote. For some advocates, however, it was too little, too late. Quote, communities under siege for years, unquote, tweeted Sherry Lynn Ifill, president of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, quote, but now, as he prepares to run for president, he's sorry, unquote. Entire item by Tara Law. Underdyed, Harrison Dillard, oldest living American Olympic champion, died on November 15th at 96. Dillard won 4 gold medals in 1948 and 1952 and is the only man to have won gold for both sprinting and hurdles. Underdyed, Kimberly Gervais, who was shot at the 2017 massacre at a Las Vegas country music festival, died on November 15th at 57. It was the deadliest shooting in modern U.S. history. Underreported that deforestation of Brazil's Amazon rainforest is occurring at the fastest rate since 2008, according to the country's space agency. Underapproved, a new North Carolina redistricting map by state legislators on November 15th. Democrats are positioned to flip 2 Republican-controlled U.S. House seats under the new plan. Under unveiled, the newest Ford Mustang, an all-electric SUV, on November 17th. Ford says the vehicle can accelerate from 0 to 60 miles per hour in less than 4 seconds. Undervisited, Walter Reed National Military Medical Center by President Trump on November 16th for what his doctor described as an, quote, interim checkup, unquote. The stop was not listed on his schedule. Underdetected, water vapor on Europa, one of Jupiter's moons. The findings, published on November 18th, have fueled speculation on whether the moon might support life. Underurged, a complete ban on all e-cigarettes and other vaping devices by the American Medical Association on November 19th. The organization cited increasing use among teenagers. That's the entire milestones page. On the facing page is the regular feature Good Question, and the headline this edition is, Why Are Democrats Attacking Pete Buttigieg? Article by Charlotte Alter. Staffers on competing Democratic campaigns have quietly snarked about South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg for months. They called him Sneaky Pete or Mayor McKenzie because of his ties to the business community, or Cream of Pete because he's so Midwestern white. But now that the millennial mayor has surged to first place in Iowa, a November 16th Des Moines Register poll had 25% of likely caucus goers listing him as their first choice, leading Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, and Joe Biden by roughly 10 points. But now all that once private griping is going public. In recent weeks, high-ranking Democrats have openly attacked Buttigieg as having a flimsy resume, uncool fan base, and lack of support among voters of color, and being insufficiently progressive. The most repeated point of criticism is Buttigieg's relative inexperience, especially compared with many of the women and non-white candidates in the race. Senator Amy Klobuchar suggested that if she or other female candidates had Buttigieg's resume, quote, I don't think people would take us seriously, unquote. Former HUD Secretary Julian Castro registered a similar complaint, quote, We would almost fit South Bend in our Alamo Dome in San Antonio, unquote, said the two-term Texas mayor. Senator Kamala Harris, who spent 20 years rising through the ranks in California before becoming the first African-American woman elected state attorney general in 2010, dismissed him as simply, quote, naive, unquote. Others have complained that the 37-year-old gay veteran has received an avalanche of positive press, far more than his competitors. Quote, it's the embodiment of the adage that men can have potential and women have to have met it, unquote, says Christina Reynolds, a spokesperson for Emily's List, an advocacy group that works to elect pro-choice Democratic women. Buttigieg spokesperson Chris Mayer downplayed fellow Democrats' irritation with the rising star. Quote, we get it, unquote, he said. Quote, we're the outsider upsetting the apple cart, unquote. But Buttigieg's many Democratic critics aren't letting up. His campaign has come under fire for its failure to win over black voters, a crucial segment of the Democratic base. Parenthetically, he's currently polling at 0% among black voters in South Carolina, according to a November 18th Quinnipiac poll. And progressive groups are attacking Buttigieg's comparatively moderate agenda. Justice Democrats has slammed the mayor for refusing to commit to policies like Medicare for All, which young people tend to support, while claiming to represent generational change. Quote, you can't weaponize your millennial identity against us, unquote, says Justice Democrats spokesman Waleed Shaheed. Strategists warn that as long as Buttigieg star is on the rise, the friendly fire will continue. Quote, he's been attacking a lot of his opponents for a while now without having any real incoming, unquote, says progressive strategist Rebecca Katz. The Pete pile-on, she says, quote, is long overdue, unquote. Entire article by Charlotte Alter. My apologies to Charlotte Alter. Sharing this page is another version of News Ticker in the left margin. And again, it's three news items stacked one on top of the other. Top item, deadly clashes in Bolivia. Crisis. Human rights groups condemned a November 15th decree by Bolivia's interim leader, Jeanine Añez, giving the armed forces legal immunity for acts committed while, quote, restoring order, unquote, after the ouster of leftist President Evo Morales. Since Añez took office on November 12th, clashes between security forces and Morales supporters have killed at least 20. Middle item. Chief Justice issues stay on Trump taxes. Days after President Trump's lawyers asked the U.S. Supreme Court to stop his tax returns from being released, Chief Justice John Roberts, on November 18th, temporarily blocked a Court of Appeals order that would have required Trump to turn over his tax returns to Congress. Bottom item. Gantz fails to form a government. Israel remained without a new government after Blue and White Party Chief Benny Gantz announced on November 20th that he could not form a coalition. With Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu having already failed, the odds rose of yet another election, the country's third in 12 months. The most recent ballot was September 17th. And that was News Ticker in its entirety. On this same page, running along the bottom of the page, under the feature title Travel, the headline is Keep It Moving. Caption explains, Australian airline Qantas completed the longest nonstop commercial test flight from London to Sydney in just over 19 hours on November 15th. Here, more long hauls, compiled by Rachel Bunyan, who lists three examples running along the bottom of the page, left and right. First item on the left, Born to Run. Ultramarathoner Dean Karnazes ran 350 continuous miles across California over 3 days in October 2005. He didn't stop to eat or sleep during his run, which lasted 80 hours, 44 minutes. Middle item, Plain Sailing. Adventurer Reed Stowe returned to New York Harbor in 2010 after spending more than 3 years sailing around the world. At 1,152 days, his trip marked the longest nonstop ocean voyage in recorded history. Last item on the far right, swimmingly. In September, American Sarah Thomas became the first person to swim the English Channel 4 times nonstop. It took Thomas, who had completed treatment for cancer a year before, just over 54 hours. English Channel 4 times nonstop, 54 hours. Moving ahead, and that brings us to the next section of the magazine, which is Opener. This sidebar feature in the right margin of this page is called Short Reads. Time explains highlights from stories on time.com/ideas. And it also lists 3 items stacked one on top of the other, 3 excerpts from time.com/ideas. Top item, Scourge of Superbugs. Former NFL defensive tackle Brandon Noble kept playing for years despite injuries, including one that should have ended his career. Quote, "What finally took me down," unquote, he writes, in a call for more powerful antibiotics. Quote, "A tiny bug I'd never heard of and couldn't see," unquote. Middle item, State of Longing. Though Michael Frank, author of What is Missing, had heard stories from others who had struggled with infertility, he wasn't prepared for the agony he and his wife would go through. Quote, "It's not just your body you hand over to complete strangers, but your mind, too," unquote, he writes. Bottom example, bottom excerpt, American Oratory. Abraham Lincoln spoke of, quote, 47 years ago, unquote, in the Gettysburg Address, a reference to the date of the Declaration of Independence's signing. But he honored ideals much older than that, writes Richard Brookhiser, author of Give Me Liberty, A History of America's Exceptional Idea. Quote, "Americans began striving for liberty before the United States was a country." And these are all excerpted from Short Reads, stories on time.com/ideas. And for those who want to make a note, that last item, author Richard Brookhiser. Brookhiser is spelled B-R-O-O-K-H-I-S-E-R. And the title of his book is Give Me Liberty, A History of America's Exceptional Idea. Moving ahead, and still in the opener, the subsection here is Health, where the headline is Rethinking Heart Treatments by Alice Park. Because heart attacks can be traced to narrowed or blocked blood vessels, doctors have relied for years on surgery to open up these restrictions with stents or bypass the blockages altogether. But best practices are sometimes based more on intuition than on the best science. In a study comparing people who had stent or bypass surgery with those who relied on medications, diet, and exercise to lower cholesterol and blood pressure, researchers found that surgery did not necessarily lower the risk of having a heart event or dying from one. After 4 years, both groups had similar rates of heart attacks and hospitalization for chest pain or heart failure. The findings are only the latest in recent years to suggest a lack of solid evidence supporting some popular standard treatments, such as arthroscopic knee surgery to relieve arthritis pain, parenthetically, exercise therapy can be just as effective, or that both resuscitation and chest compressions are needed in CPR to revive a failing heart. Parenthetically, chest compressions alone can work. Sometimes it seems less is more. Entire article by Alice Park. Moving ahead to make sure we get as much material into this session as possible, we are now at a major article entitled "The Fight for Our Faces: China Shows the Worrying Future of the Surveillance State." Article by Charlie Campbell. Every morning, Mrs. Chen dons her bright purple Tai Chi pajamas and joins the dozen or so members of Hongmen Martial Arts Group for practice outside Chongqing's Jingnan Stadium. But a few months ago, she was in such a rush to join their whirling sword dance routine that she dropped her purse. Fortunately, a security guard noticed it lying in the public square via one of the overhead security cameras. He placed it at the lost and found, where Mrs. Chen gratefully retrieved it later. Quote, "Were it not for these cameras, someone might have stolen it," unquote. Mrs. Chen, who asked to be identified by only her surname, tells Time, on a smoggy morning in China's sprawling central megacity. Quote, "Having these cameras everywhere makes me feel safe," unquote. What sounds like a lucky escape is almost to be expected in Chongqing, which has the dubious distinction of being the world's most surveilled city. The seething mass of 15.35 million people straddling the confluence of the Yangtze and Jialing rivers boasted 2.58 million surveillance cameras in 2019, according to an analysis published in August by the tech research website Comparatech. That's a frankly Orwellian ratio of one closed-circuit TV camera for every 5.9 citizens, or 30 times their prevalence in Washington, D.C. Every move in the city is seemingly captured digitally. Cameras perch over sidewalks, hover across busy intersections, and swivel above shopping districts. But Chongqing is by no means unique. 8 of the top 10 most surveilled cities in the world are in China, according to Comparatech, as the world's number 2 economy rolls out an unparalleled system of social control. Facial recognition software is used to access office buildings, snare criminals, and even shame jaywalkers at busy intersections. China today is a harbinger of what society looks like when surveillance proliferates unchecked. But while few nations have embraced surveillance the way China has, it is far from alone. Surveillance has become an everyday part of life in most developed societies, aided by an explosion in AI-powered facial recognition technology. Last year, London police made their first arrest based on facial recognition by cross-referencing photos of pedestrians in tourist hotspots with a database of known felons. A few months earlier, a trial of facial recognition software by police in New Delhi reportedly recognized 3,000 missing children in just 4 days. In August, a wanted drug trafficker was captured in Brazil after facial recognition software spotted him at a subway station. The technology is widespread in the U.S., too. It has aided in the arrest of alleged credit card swindlers in Colorado and a suspected rapist in Pennsylvania. Still, the risks are considerable. As Western democracies enact safeguards to protect citizens from the rampant harvesting of data by government and corporations, China is exporting its AI-powered surveillance technology to authoritarian governments around the world. Chinese firms are providing high-tech surveillance tools to at least 18 nations, from Venezuela to Zimbabwe, according to a 2018 report by Freedom House. China is a battleground where the modern surveillance state has reached a nadir, prompting censure from governments and institutions around the globe. But it is also where rebellion against its overreach is being most ferociously fought. Quote, "Today's economic business models all encourage people to share data," unquote, says Lachman Sui, a privacy expert at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. In China, he adds, we are seeing, quote, what happens when the state goes after that data to exploit and weaponize it, unquote. Some 1,500 miles southwest of where Mrs. Chen recovered her purse, surveillance in China's restive region of Xinjiang has helped put an estimated 1 million people into, quote, re-education centers, unquote, akin to concentration camps, according to the UN. Many were arrested, tried, and convicted by computer algorithm based on data harvested by the cameras that stood every 20 steps in some parts. In the name of fighting terrorism, members of predominantly Muslim ethnic groups, mostly Uyghurs, but also Kazakhs, Uzbeks, and Kyrgyz, are forced to surrender biometric data like photos, fingerprints, DNA, blood, and voice samples. Police are armed with a smartphone app that then automatically flags certain behaviors, according to reverse engineering by the advocacy group Human Rights Watch. Those who grow a beard, leave their house via a back door, or visit the mosque often are red flagged by the system and interrogated. Sasinbek Akaruli, 45, a veterinarian and a trader from the Xinjiang city of Ili, a trader is spelled T-R-A-D-E-R, Akaruli was arrested on November 2nd, 2017, and remains in a detention camp after police found the banned messaging app WhatsApp on his cell phone, according to his wife, Gulnor Kozdolet. A citizen of neighboring Kazakhstan, she has traveled to Xinjiang 4 times to search for him, but found even friends in the ruling Chinese Communist Party, parenthetically CCP, reluctant to help. Quote, nobody wanted to risk being recorded on security cameras talking to me in case they ended up in the camps themselves, unquote, she tells Time. Surveillance governs all aspects of camp life. Bakitali Noor, 47, a fruit and vegetable exporter in the Xinjiang town of Korgos, was arrested after authorities became suspicious of his frequent business trips abroad. The father of three says he spent a year in a single room with 7 other inmates all clad in blue jumpsuits, forced to sit still on plastic stools for 17 hours straight as four Hikvision cameras recorded every move. Quote, anyone caught talking or moving was forced into stress positions for hours at a time, unquote, he says. Bakatali was released only after he developed a chronic illness. But his surveillance hell continued over 5 months of virtual house arrest, which is common for former detainees. He was forbidden from traveling outside his village without permission, and a closed-circuit TV camera was installed opposite his home. Every time he approached the front door, a policeman would call to ask where he was going. He had to report to the local government office every day to undergo, quote, political education, unquote, and write a self-criticism detailing his previous day's activities. Unable to travel for work, former detainees like Bakatali are often obliged to toil at government factories for wages as miserly as 35 cents per day, according to former workers interviewed by Time. Quote, the entire system is designed to suppress us, unquote, Bakatali says in Almaty, Kazakhstan, where he escaped in May. The result is dystopian. When every aspect of life is under constant scrutiny, it's not just bad behavior that must be avoided, and bad was in quotation marks. Muslims in Xinjiang are under constant pressure to act in a manner that the CCP would approve. While posting controversial material online is clearly reckless, not using social media at all could also be considered suspicious. So Muslims share glowing news about the country and party as a means of defense. Homes and businesses now feel obliged to display a photograph of China's president, Xi Jinping, in a manner redolent of North Korean's public displays for founder Kim Il-sung. Asked why he had a picture of Xi in his taxi, one Uyghur driver replied nervously, quote, it's the law, unquote. Besides the surveillance cameras, people are required to register their ID numbers for activities as mundane as renting a karaoke booth. Muslims are forced from buses to have their IDs checked, while ethnic Han Chinese passengers wait in their seats. At intersections, drivers are ushered from their vehicles by armed police and through TerraSnap, quote, revolving body detector, unquote, equipment. In the southern Xinjiang oasis town of Hotan, a facial recognition booth is even installed at the local produce market. When a system struggled to compute the face of this Western Time reporter, the impatient Han woman queuing behind berated the operator, quote, hurry up, he's not a Uyghur, let him through, unquote. China strenuously denies human rights abuses in Xinjiang, justifying its surveillance leviathan as battling the, quote, three evils, unquote, of, quote, separatism, terrorism, and extremism, unquote. But the situation has been described as a, quote, horrific campaign of repression, unquote, by the U.S. and condemned by the U.N. Washington has also started sanctioning companies like Hikvision, whose facial recognition technology is ubiquitous across the Alaska-sized region. But Western aversion to surveillance is much broader and stems in no small part from abuses like the Facebook Cambridge Analytica scandal, in which the, quote, scraped, unquote, personal information of up to 87 million people was acquired by the political consultancy, Cambridge Analytica, to swing elections around the world. China is also rolling out big data and surveillance to inculcate, quote, positive, unquote, behavior in its citizens via a social credit system. In China's eastern coastal city of Rongcheng, home to 670,000 people, every person is automatically given 1,000 points. Fighting with neighbors will cost you 5 points. Fail to clean up after your dog and you lose 10. Donating blood gains 5. Fall below a certain threshold and it's impossible to get a loan or book high-speed train tickets. Some Chinese see the benefit. And we have just about run out of time for this edition of Time Magazine. And this was a double issue dated December 2nd and also December 9th. So it's going to be around for a while. This content is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And you've been listening to North Carolina Reading Service. I'm Randall Rickman, your reader for Time. Thanking once again for joining us. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, NCReadingService.org, formerly known as Triangle Reading Service. I'll repeat that with apologies. NCReadingService.org, available 24/7. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Your number again, 919-832-5138. I'm Randall Rickman, and once again, we've certainly enjoyed having your presence with us. You are the reason that we have Time for Time. Please join us next time for Time.